We talking rom-com, we talking action, we talking drama and movie classics. Whatever you want, yo, we have it, cause we talking movies on a podcast. So I married a film critic. So I married a film critic. So I married a film critic.
Hey honey, I just wanna talk about the movie like casually. You don't have to bring up the cinematography. Honestly, let's just talk about like how the characters were fun.
Married a film critic. So I married a film critic.
Welcome to So I Married a Film Critic. I'm your co-host Julia.
And I'm Barry the Film Critic. Hello everyone.
And tonight, we decided, actually, no, we no, did not decide to do this.
This is not our choice. Yes, my dear brother Marty, Julia has begged me not to sing it as I did last week. So Marty, my dear brother Marty, who's also the producer of this show and the editor, he picked four films for us to watch and review that we had never heard of. So completely blind, never saw a trailer, nothing, just no knowledge of these movies beforehand. We previously spoke about a film called Other People, and this week we're going to talk about a film called Sudden Fear.
That's right, Sudden Fear from 1952.
Yes, directed by David Miller and starring Joan Crawford and Jack Palance.
And I gotta say, I have never seen a young Jack Palance.
It's stunning, isn't it?
I mean, City Slickers is probably the only movie I've ever seen with him.
Really? It's funny because certainly, I mean, even, you know, I'm in my 40s, but I think of Jack Palance in the latter part of his life. Likewise, his career is fascinating. We'll get into it, but I mean, he's probably best known for City Slickers, and why wouldn't he be? He won the Academy Award at the age of 73. Did you see that when that happened?
Yeah, I saw him do a armed push-up on the stage.
The Will Smith slap thing is nothing compared to this. So yeah, he gets up on stage. This is in 1992. He gets Best Supporting Actor for City Slickers. Billy Crystal was the host of the Oscars that year, and of course that was his star in City Slickers. We'll talk about Sudden Fear in a second. So Palance goes up to stage and he looks at Billy Crystal and goes, "Billy Crystal, I crap bigger than him." And then he proceeds to like give this speech, and he talks about basically how he keeps himself in shape. So then he drops down and does a one-handed push-up. And I mean, not just like one, I mean, he puts one hand behind his back and he starts doing push-ups at the age of 73 with the Oscar in his other hand. It's like, oh my God, this man is amazing.
Yeah. You clearly loved this moment.
Well, I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was bizarre. It was incredible. It's like, wow, it's suddenly not a big deal that he just beat Harvey Keitel, because look at him. He's incredible. And it led to a whole second career for him. It was kind of one of these Leslie Nielsen things where he had a long career prior, but then suddenly, you know, at the latter part of the 20th century, everybody knew who Jack Palance was, primarily because of City Slickers.
Right. Yeah. So when we were going to watch this movie, he comes on stage and I'm like, wait, is that Jack Palance? Because I had no context for what he looked like as a younger man. And at first I thought, oh, yeah, he's kind of handsome. But you guys, this movie really just... Ooh, I hate him so much.
Oh, come on. We should give it to him. Come on. He's a handsome Ukrainian. He's a handsome dude.
He's got some major cheekbones.
Yeah, made big time. I mean, let's give him...
His cheekbones rival Joan Crawford.
It's the character. It's not him. He's a good-looking dude. It's very interesting seeing him paired against Joan Crawford, who I always think of as very glamorous, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll get into it. I mean, they got killer chemistry, and to bury the lead a little bit, we both really dig this film a lot.
Yeah, I really liked this movie, and there are some wacky things that happen, so let's get started.
Let's dig into it.
We open in New York City. Jack Palance is on stage at a play rehearsal tryout, and Joan Crawford is the playwright for this play. And the people financing the play love Jack Palance, whose character is Lester, and she just is not into him. She's like, he's not... a romantic lead. He's not giving her those romantic vibes at all. And so even though he's a fine actor, she said, she just doesn't want him in her play.
Yeah.
So.
And she ridicules him basically. And basically just just shoos him off. I mean, it's a very painful thing to watch because, you know, he's a good actor. And he just killed the monologue, but for whatever reason, she doesn't want him to play. And he's, you know, it's this really embarrassing moment for him.
Yeah, and he, so the guys who are financing it, which by the way, $85,000 to finance this play. And I believe this film does actually take place in 1952. Is that right?
I think so.
$892,000 for this play.
Today, that's peanuts. Today, that's like love letters. That's like a play of two people reading a letter together. No, I mean, I think, let me think if I can remember this correctly. I remember, you know, I think the most expensive Broadway musical of all time currently, I think that record currently goes to Spider-Man. Remember the Spider-Man musical?
Yeah, never even played?
No. It played. Oh. But they were, I mean, they couldn't keep up with it. I mean, you know, it would sell out and sell out and sell out. But the thing is, it cost so much money to keep it in the theater, they had to get rid of it. But, I mean, Paul Simon did a musical called The Cape Man. I think that was like $11 million. Cats, I know, was millions of dollars. So, yeah, you know, it's eventually Broadway became a very expensive thing to have these, you know, these big monster shows. But from the looks of it, this is not even, I mean, this isn't like Oklahoma. It's like, it's a little drama.
Yeah. Who knows? I don't even really know what her play is about, but he tells her off on stage from the stage. And he's like, have you ever been to San Francisco? You know, there's some kind of statue of Casanova. And he goes into this big, long thing about how she knows nothing.
It's great. Yeah. Oh, man.
That's all for today, everybody. Oh, Mr. Blaine, can I see you a moment?
Anne, anything in the morning mail that needs an immediate answer?
A telegram from San Francisco from Steve Carney, and Charles Hoyt phoned about an interview, and the Dramatists Guild asked if you can attend a committee meeting Saturday evening.
Friday at 2 for Mr. Hoyt. Tell the Guild I'm in rehearsal, but I'll try. Wire Steve that the play opens on the 21st, and I'll take the train to San Francisco on the following Monday.
Miss Hudson! In your own native city of San Francisco, there's an art gallery in the Legion of Honor in which there's an oil painting of Casanova. It's quite obvious that you've never seen this painting. For your information, Miss Hudson, this is what Casanova looked like. He had big ears, a scar over one eye, a broken nose, and a wart on his chin. Right here. I suggest, Miss Hudson, that when you return to San Francisco, you visit this gallery and see this painting.
Mr. Blaine!
And I've been there, buddy.
Yeah, you've been there.
Oh, man, you're kidding? No, like, I mean, you know my dear friend Sana, but I mean, I've certainly auditioned for directors who are awful. I didn't get the role. I've had auditions where I bombed hard and they did not make it. This is like so satisfying to see a movie open like this. Like, yes! Oh, I wish I had said something like that.
Yeah, except her play was a hit without him.
Well, I've been there too. I've had that bitterness. Yeah.
So she's, you know, basking in all the glory of this hit play. And then she leaves for San Francisco, which is where she lives, by train. And she sees Lester, Mr. Blaine.
Played by Jack Palance.
Yeah, on the train. And she's like, oh, well, what's he doing here? And he walks by and she's like, Mr. Blaine. And she's in her car and she invites him in for a drink, and he orders the same drink as her, and she tries to, throughout the course of this train ride, keep bringing up what happened and kind of apologize for it, saying, like, you don't really, you know, sorry that this was so hard on you, but I'd like to explain myself. And he's like, no, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. So you kind of get the feeling that it's fine. But you guys, we find out it is not
fine. Don't bury the lead. So there's this long sequence of them on the train together. And I got to say, I found this part of the film to be very intoxicating. Not only does, of all people, not only do Joan Crawford and Jack Palance have great chemistry, but it's very involving. And the dialogue's involving. It's visually splendid. I love movies that have a good portion of them that take place on a train. And I like that, you know, the narrative builds, the character builds in this whole sequence, and it becomes like a travelogue for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they play poker together, they have all their meals together, basically falling in love.
Yeah.
And he changes his ticket to stay on with her and go all the way to San Francisco. He was supposed to get off earlier. And at one point, he asks her, you know, why do you work? Because she is a very wealthy woman. Her father left her a ton of money, property, real estate, everything. And she says, to stand on my own two feet, not just stand on my father's fortune. So, you know, you get the sense that she really wants to make a name for herself outside of just her dad's money. But, you know, do you think she'd really be a famous playwright without that?
And I'm really glad, though, that this distinction is made, because for the first half of the movie, I'm wondering, wait a second, this is a very glamorous life for a playwright.
Right.
See, like, where she's living. Like, David Mamet doesn't have a house this big. Especially, like, I mean, this isn't like Andrew Lloyd Webber. Like, she's writing.
I mean, now he probably does.
Mamet? I don't know. But, she's, like, making Andrew Lloyd Webber money, you know? Like, this is crazy, crazy, you know, sort of, this sort of glamour and glitz that she's living in. But, yeah, it makes sense that, you know, the fact that she's a playwright, obviously she's good at it and she's deserved her success, but clearly the opulence was there before the career.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, sharing stories, playing games, holding hands. They get to San Francisco and meet up with another couple friend of hers, and there's dinner and dancing. They really seem into each other. I mean, do you think they have good chemistry?
Great chemistry. No, I love these scenes. I really do. Even to watch them dance together. I mean, like, it's because I've seen him in so many Westerns and I've seen her in so many other kind of different kind of films. They just, you know, just to look at the names, like, no. Joan Crawford and Jack Palance would not have any chemistry together. No, that's ridiculous. No, they do. They really do. They're fabulous together, and I really like them as a couple, and I like the dynamic.
So the film makes a special point to talk about her special dictating machine that she has set up in her office.
And you know, it's going to be trouble when these things come out.
Yep.
It's like a Nightmare Alley.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Maria, Kate Blanchett and Nightmare
That's
Alley.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So she says, I had it made it special. She had it like created specifically for her, where she turns it on and then anytime she talks while it's on, it will record what she's saying. And so she's like, do you want to see how it works? And so she turns it on and then asks him, like, go ahead, say something. Because it will record her no matter where she is around the room. There must be who knows how many microphones in this office. But he starts quoting her own words,
yeah,
like from a play that she's written. And you can tell she's like, oh, nobody's ever read my words back to me like that.
Well, when I wake in the morning, when I go to sleep at night, I think of you. You're like the air which surrounds me, the sky which spreads above me, the earth beneath my feet. When I hear music, when I see beauty, when I breathe in the sunlight, I think of you. You are the sister I never had. The mother I have almost forgotten, the wife I have always dreamed of. There isn't a relationship you can name which exists between a man and a woman of which I wouldn't say, let it be you. Or let it be you.
It's very flattering to be quoted. I'll play it back for you.
I mean, truly, you can't appeal to a narcissist more than quoting a play that she wrote. So, yeah.
And then they listen back. They listen to it back. So in real time, we are listening to him recite her play. And then she plays it back for them. And they're just looking at each other.
It's a sexy scene. It is.
It kind of reminded me of the scene from, you're going to hate this.
Uh-oh. Which one?
The one you hate that we talked about, the Christmas one.
The Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, yeah, It's a Wonderful Life. Where
scene? It's a Wonderful Life.
Where the main characters are on the phone with Hee-Haw guy.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, and they're standing really close together, and they're just having this like moment of like major chemistry.
You know, you could have mentioned another film that we've seen recently called Notorious, where Cary Grant and...
Oh, I could have mentioned that, but I didn't think of that.
Yeah, those, you know, their kissing scene that goes on. Remember? Yeah, remember that? Ugh, you had to mention Capra. Anyway.
Anyways, okay. So they kiss each other. like while they're listening to him recite her play.
It's pretty hot stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty good. So then, you know, we get some montage of them exploring San Francisco.
Great stuff. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Real shot on location. There are a few times where you could see there's some front projection action where I think at one point they're looking over a balcony or looking at the bridge, I think. And clearly they're just looking at a screen that's, you know, showing the bridge. But for the most part, I mean, great use of San Francisco.
Yeah. I mean, they go to see the Redwoods. They go on the Golden Lombard Gate Street. Bridge.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, yeah, real sense of the environment. It's great. I mean, you can't fake this in the studio, obviously.
So she throws a party for him to meet her friends and everything. And he is 2 hours late. So she tries calling him.
Yeah.
And this is where you kind of get the first indication
something's wrong, because we see in his apartment, he's pacing back and forth while the phone is ringing. Like, yeah, that's cool.
He's there. He's not answering. He's just smoking. You know, and she's at her house like, where is he? He would not do this unless something had happened.
And I got to say, movie, I mean, like, you know, hook, line, and sinker. I was definitely believing this romantic buildup. So the fact that there's something wrong, it's like, oh geez, I didn't realize something was up here.
Yeah, so she's worried. She goes to see if he's okay, and she finds him at his apartment, and this is his line. Like, he doesn't feel like he has a proper place in her world. And she says, without you, I have nothing. And I was like, ooh, is he playing her?
He's got his bags packed. Yeah. I mean, it's a very big gesture on his part.
Yeah. It's a pretty big, like, you know, you don't need me. And she's already fallen in love with him. And I'm like, is he playing her now? That's where I wrote, like, calculating.
Oh, I mean, it's like. It's you know, it's not you, it's me. I'm leaving town. Like, this isn't happening.
I'm out of here. And so she's like, no, without you, I have nothing. Because she's thinking, like, I don't know how old she is in this movie. But she's clearly, like, not in her 20s.
Yes. And she definitely goes all in at this point. Because they are being very careful about their feelings. But this is a very unabashed, transparent moment for her.
Right. You know, I'm guessing she's, like, more middle age, maybe
40s. Yeah.
I mean, all right, you know, we're in our 40s.
Hollywood middle age.
Hollywood middle age.
So you got to take that down a decade. So she's about 35.
Really?
That's what Joan Crawford would want
back
us to
then
say.
Really, but old to be not married. Oh my gosh.
Exactly, man. You're like an old maid if you're not married by like 29.
Yeah, exactly. So she's, I don't know what her, we don't know anything about her past except that she's from a wealthy family. So who knows? But they jump and they get married right away.
Mm-hmm.
And go to their honeymoon. They have, it turns out she has a summer house not too far away. And they have a reception party. And I'm just thinking, like, okay, this is great. This is a great love story, except we know it's film noir. So, you know.
Yeah, and I got to say, though, I mean, I really wasn't sure exactly where that angle was coming, because it just seems like she's run into this actor who she had this terrible experience with back in the day, and he just happens to be sweet and charming.
Back in the day, how long ago had it been since her play? What? How long is a play run?
Well, I mean, it's been at least, what, a year? Well, it depends on how long the play runs, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is like what? Streetcar Named Desire on play for a few years. This is like Cats, where it's playing for 30 years. Like, how long do you think?
How much time do I think has passed? Yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about that. I think maybe year, like right? six months to a year.
I'd say a year. Yeah.
You think a year?
Especially a drama on Broadway at this time. Yeah, I'd say a year. If it's a successful
year. It's not what you say back in the day. It's not like it's been a decade.
No, but it's been a while. I mean, it's been so long that, I mean, we can relate to this, right? Where you run into somebody and the last time you saw them, it was kind of unpleasant or ugly. But like, so much time has passed that you're able to have a comfortable conversation with them. It's mm-hmm. that long.
Yeah. All right. I think about a year is right.
Yep.
Okay. So now we see that a mystery woman shows up. Irene.
Yes. Playboy. Gloria Graham, I believe. Yeah. Gloria Graham.
And Lester like totally threatens her. And you see them at this apartment. And he is like Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I don't know. I wrote, is she his first wife? And like, who is she? What's going on? He like pushes her down on the couch and, you know, physically threatens her. And so now I'm like, oh, okay, the plot thickens. Lester also shows up at Myra's lawyer's office and he's talking to him about like getting a job. And he doesn't want to just rely on his wife's money and he wants to support himself. So we're getting like a lot of mixed messages now. Like, who is this guy really? So now we find out Lester's using Irene to get info on where his wife's money is going. And he kisses her. So you're like, okay, obviously they're together in some way. And he finds out that Myra is giving away all of her father's money. And I think to some charity. Okay. So she meets with, so Myra meets with her lawyer and he's like, hey, I wrote down, I typed this up for you. I want you to look at it. And she reads it and she's like, oh my gosh, like, no, it says that upon her death, Lester would get $10,000 a year until he remarries. And she's like horrified. She's like, no, I do not want to hold him hostage from the grave. Like, I'm changing this. And the lawyer was like, do what you want. Like, I'll change it, but we got to get this done. And so Myra dictates on her dictating machine what Lester's going to get. And she, on the machine, she says something like, he gets all my property. It doesn't matter if he remarries. You know, it's very generous. So then she has to go, she has to leave the room and somehow leaves the dictating machine on. All right. So then we get to, all right.
The Whopper.
Okay. So Myra goes back in to work on the will and she plays back what she had already dictated.
Turns out some stuff happened in that room while she was away. Yeah,
so you hear her stuff. And then she goes to, I don't know, restart the recording. And it's Lester and Irene talking.
What's up?
Listen, Junior's told me something I think you ought to know. She's made a new will.
Go on.
That's what Steve had to see her about. He's leaving with Junior for Sacramento for 3 days. When they return on Monday, the will is to be signed.
Why the rush?
I don't know.
How do I stand it?
I couldn't find out.
If Steve rigged it, I'll be out flat on my face. Why couldn't you find out?
What excuse can I give Junior for asking? I take enough chances as it is.
This part of the loving bridegroom is beginning to crawl out of my ears.
You know the lines. Just keep on saying them, and you do it good.
Sometimes when I'm with her, it's all I can do to keep from saying, be yourself, wise up. Love you? I never loved you. Never for one moment. I'd like to see her face.
You're talking crazy.
Come here.
Take it easy. I've got to go back downstairs.
Just once more.
Oh, you smeared my lipstick. I've got to fix it before somebody comes. Where's the mirror?
Here, by the desk. Just to hold you like this, it's all I dream about.
Lester, don't.
I don't know how I stand it not being with you.
What's this on the desk?
It's the will.
Last will and testament of Myra Hudson Blaine.
Let's see where I come in. J.V. Hudson Foundation. Oh, that's not it. Here it is. To my husband, Lester Blaine, on my death, $10,000 a year.
Is that all?
Get a load of this. Until he remarries.
And you thought you were playing it so smart, not taking anything from it. No presents, no jewelry, no handouts, no nothing.
Oh, if that dirty double-crossing dame thinks
Listen,
she can...
she can't sign it till Monday.
Did Junior say that?
She comes into the rest of her old man's money Monday. She can't dispose of it till it's hers.
She doesn't sign the will until Monday, so what's the difference?
Suppose she isn't able to sign it on Monday.
What do you mean?
Suppose something happened to her between now and Monday. Who'd get her money?
Her husband. Lester Blaine. I'd get it all. Why not?
Sure. Why not?
Rich. You and me rich.
Lester, I have a gun.
Gun's no good.
that's easy.
Not too easy. We've got 3 days. I've got to be smart. As her husband, I'd be suspected before she was called.
3 days. We'll work it out. Kiss me. Kiss me. Hard.
Crazy about you. I could break your bones.
And they're just like, okay, the will, like, how much are you getting? And he's like, I don't know. And they find the will on her desk, and he finds out about this $10,000 a year until he gets remarried. And she's like, you thought you were playing it so safe by not getting anything from her and asking her for anything. And now look, you're going to get nothing. You're getting pennies and you can't even get remarried, you know? So then they talk about, oh, well, if she doesn't, she's signing the will on Monday. And I think it's Friday or something, Thursday or Friday. And they said, well, what if there's an accident before she signs the will? Like, who then gets all the money? Her husband. So they're scheming now. Now there's a plot to kill Myra in an accident so that Lester can get all the money. And the look on Joan Crawford's face throughout this whole scene, I mean, the eyes could not be any wider. Like, any, she is just, and it's terrible. And Lester is like, oh, I wish I could see her face while I'm like, you know, I never loved her. And he's like, oh, I just want to be with you. I could break your bones right now. I was like, dang, dude.
Yeah. Two things about this scene. For one thing, it's implied that stuff is going on while they're doing this, because at one point, Jack Palance's character Lester says, let's do it again. I'm like, do what again, movie? This is 1952. What are you referring to, Jack Palance?
No, I think there's some sexy sex going on.
While the recording, yeah. Mm. No. And the movie is very careful about this, but clearly from the dialogue, yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of, let's just say, like, you don't want to put a black light in that office afterwards. And then this really, I found to be really chilling. Was because, you know, because seriously, like, not only are we hearing this murder plot, but, you know, we're watching Joan Crawford react to this plot against her. And there's a great, I mean, there's a number of them, but there's a great shot here where the camera is looking at the empty room and looking at her, really emphasizing, like, this space was once filled by these two people doing these things, saying these things. It's awful. But I came up with something as I watched. I'm like, you know what? A really easy way for Jack Palance to, like, get away with this, you know, after, like, you know, talking about sex and murdering his wife, just to go, and scene.
Yeah, but he would have
just
to.
Just kidding.
He would have to know he was being recorded.
He should have done it anyway.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so I.
Just kidding, honey. How's that sound for your new play, huh?
Oh,
just trying out some new dialogue.
Gosh. Well, Irene then lets it out that she has a gun.
Yeah.
And he's like,
it's
no.
It's insane. They lay everything out on this tape.
They
do.
It's crazy. They talk about everything.
Oh, man.
In her office, which you're like, okay. Even if you don't think the machine is on, wouldn't you, like, be aware that...
You probably shouldn't, like, give your whole murder plot away anywhere near a dictaphone.
Yeah, exactly. So he's like, well, no, it has to be an accident because I'm going to be, like, suspect number one, you know? Okay, so then the worst part, I mean, I think I yelled out loud.
You did.
Was, so Myra takes the little disc out. It's more like a small record.
Yeah.
And she's like, I got to, like, put this in a safe place. I got, this is, you know, confession on here. And she gets up on, like, a stool. She goes to put it up on her bookshelf, and you guys, she drops it and it shatters.
No,
it is
no.
Devastating. I literally was like, no, what are you doing?
You got nothing.
So now she has this knowledge and no way to prove it. Ugh. Oh, and I did write Joan Crawford's eyes! ! Her acting with her eyes is something else.
Yeah, oh, she's sensational. Yeah, she is.
Yeah. So she's thinking about all the possible accidents, you know, and she falls asleep. And Lester comes home to her screaming. because she's thinking about all the ways, like dreaming about all the ways that she could be killed.
Like, yeah. Oh my gosh. I like it. It's a great montage.
And so Lester comes in and wakes her up, and she's like, oh, I just had a bad dream and I have a headache. And she's just looking at him like with so much distrust, and he doesn't know that she knows, obviously, but she fakes a headache, and he wants to give her like medicine and sleeping pills and all this stuff. And she's just like, no, I'm fine. And then you find out they sleep in separate rooms.
It is a movie in 1952, though. I mean, yeah. I don't know if that's the most honest detail. It could just be an issue of like,
I think it's because they have money.
These are two attractive people. We cannot imply that there is one bed in this room that they are both sleeping in.
No, they imply that, because later on, a character asks, it must have been Irene, because I don't think anybody else knows about this plot, how he's been faking it with her this whole time and how she wouldn't know. And he basically says, well, he's really good in bed.
What's that line you quoted earlier that he says to Irene on the recording? What's the thing that he says to her?
I'm going to break your bones.
Yeah.
I want to break your bones. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I was like, this guy is psycho. Because he like, oh, yeah.
I remember being a kid, you know, and like I would have relatives or grandparents. I squeeze my cheeks, but I just want to eat you up. And it's like, okay, but This is next level weird.
This is, yeah. So he says that to Irene, but I think he tells her, like, the reason Myra totally doesn't know is because he's given it to her in bed, like, big time. She's having a great time.
Go Jack Palance.
So the movie's not shying away from that.
Right.
But what I mean is, like, it doesn't matter if they share a room or they have separate rooms.
Well, I mean, this is during like the Hays Code, and you know, like censorship is definitely. I mean, the 50s were kind of famous for that. You know, the Hollywood studios would get away from a lot of that by the time you get to the 1960s, late 60s in particular. But this is at a time. But no, I agree with you. Like, there's some insidious stuff in this movie, which is pretty amazing because this is the same year that Singing in the Rain came out. So it's pretty incredible, you know. And then, meanwhile, in another theater, this movie's playing.
All right. So she stays up all night because she's...
It's an eerie scene.
Yeah. All night. Yeah. She's just like staying awake and doesn't want... Well, she's scared of him now.
Yeah, of course. Obviously. We are too. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering what he's capable of now. What is he going to try and break her bones? I mean, we don't know. And not in the, you know, way he wants to break Irene's bones. We don't know what's happening.
Just want to break your bones. Jeez, Jack Palance.
So she gets up and gets dressed, sneaks into his room, and steals the key to his apartment. Because that's another thing in the recording she heard, that he's got a key and Irene wants him to give it back. But he's kind of like, no way, I'm going to come over and we're going to, like, get it on, you know?
They're going to break some bones tonight. Maybe femur.
Oh, my God.
Maybe bicuspid. Stop by
that. That doesn't even make sense.
I'm going to start with the teeth. Work
my way down. This is getting weird. Okay.
Oh, no, it's getting weird.
Okay, but she steals a key to his apartment and goes and makes a copy.
It's a very suspenseful scene, I must say. Yeah. I've seen variations on this, but this is a very well staged, and it's eerie because we're looking at him asleep as she is, and it's like, who is this guy?
Right. But she comes back. I was like, okay, I don't know how long it took her to steal the key, go get a copy made, and come back, but he's still asleep when she gets back.
Yeah.
And she goes to put it on the desk, and then he wakes up. So then at this point, it's almost like she snaps out of her fear trance and is like, I got to play this part to save my life. Yep. So I got to go back to loving newlywed wife who's really into her husband. And she puts the key down, picks up his lighter, and goes to light a cigarette for him.
Yeah.
And that's how she wakes him up. I was like, dang, who wants to smoke right when they wake up?
It's the 50s.
I guess.
It's like, you know, you start your day with coffee, cigarette, and last night's pizza.
Yeah, and she's like, oh, I'm really sorry about last night, you know, just had that headache. And he's like, oh, I'm glad you're feeling better. You know, now it's like, okay, we're watching them both.
Yeah, cat and mouse.
Acting with each other. Yeah. So, all right. So she tells him she wants to go to the summer house for the weekend. And you can tell he's panicking. He's like, oh, okay, well, if you go to the summer house, you know, and she's like, it'll be like a second honeymoon. Because what the thing about the summer house, and they showed this on their honeymoon, it's up on like a cliff.
Yeah.
And there's these really steep stairs and there's water down below. Yeah, railing. And he's like, oh, you got to be careful. And so she tells him, like, why don't you go up there? Warm it up, because it's not the summertime. You know, get a fire going, make sure it's ready for me, and then like come back and get me, because I'm not ready to go yet. We'll go on Sunday. And then he's like thinking, oh, yeah, I'm going to go up to the summer house and I'm going to like plan the accident. So that's what we're thinking as the audience is, okay, there's going to be, I'm thinking, oh, he's going to try and push her down the stairs or, you know, something like that. So he goes up there with Irene, and there is a scene of them kind of like planning things. So Myra goes to the apartment. I think, what, does she know that he's going to bring Irene? Because that's kind of a plot hole then. How would she know that Irene's not going to be there?
That's a good question.
Yeah. All right. So she steals a paper from, this is now we're going to like find out what her plot is, because she's going to try and trap them. But she takes paper from the apartment and writes two notes, one from Lester to Irene, one from Irene to Lester. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's got like, she copies their penmanship, like exactly. It's crazy.
She is an award-winning playwright. She should be good at this.
Oh, oh my gosh. She's really good at dictating. No one said anything about her handwriting.
She's like, I've had two Broadway hit shows. I should be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. So she writes down on the notes, you know, basically, okay, Lester, I have a plan, you know, meet me at my apartment. And then to Irene, I have a plan, meet me at the garage. And so she's like telling them to go to different places. All right.
Very impressive.
Very impressive. Because I'm like, what's her plan? Then he comes back to get her and she's like, no, we're not going to go to the summer house anymore. She totally breaks the plan. We have this dinner thing. We have this party. You know, it's all planned, blah, blah, blah. I just slipped my mind. I totally forgot. And you can tell that, you know, he is just like, dang it. She keeps messing with my plan for an accident. But Myra gets ready to, she's getting ready for this party, and her and Irene, I didn't realize until at the end of the movie, but they are dressed alike for a reason. They're both wearing white dresses with white, you know, headscarves.
Classic film noir look, by the way.
Oh, really?
The femme fatale. Yep.
Okay. And then you see Myra getting ready and she puts like shoe polish on her ankle underneath her stockings and she fake falls down the stairs, pretends to twist her ankle. Guess I can't go to this party. And somehow she manages to like slip the notes to Lester and Irene so that they both have them in this time frame. And he puts her to bed and he's like, oh, do you want me to read to you? Like, okay. She fake falls asleep. And now we're like getting into the final act of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything you want to say about that?
No, this movie is brisk. I got to say, like, it moves. Even the early stuff, the stuff in the train doesn't feel too long. It feels like, I mean, this film is so well paced, especially for a film, you know, considering when it came out. It's not that older films are necessarily slow, but I mean, they tend to take their time. And this movie is character driven. It's really not plot driven. It has a great plot, but it's really about character. Mm-hmm. But it's still like, it, yeah, this thing is just, it's just forward motion the whole way.
So what I thought was kind of funny was, you know, when she gets up from her fake sleep and she puts the same dress back on, by the way. And she's sitting at her little desk in her room and she's, now you see what her original plan is. Her plan is to go over to the apartment. Irene is gone. She's at the garage and she steals the gun because she knows where it is from the last time she was at the apartment. And when Lester comes, she shoots him dead. She leaves and then it shows like Irene in this like fake court hearing, you know, scene. And he's like, you are sentenced to life in jail for murder, you know. So that's her whole plan, is to frame Irene for Lester's murder so she can just get rid of both of them. Hmm. And I was like, oh, all right, that's what she's going to do. But then the movie, I mean, takes us on a totally different ride.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of glad.
Well, it's film noir. I mean, film noirs are about moral compromise, you know. So it's, mm-hmm. it is this sense of, that's one of my favorite things about these sort of movies where it's a love triangle. Kind of, only in the sense like, you know, they don't intend it to be a triangle.
Right.
You know, they think it's just a straight line, but it's a triangle. And it's this whole thing of, you know, life would be better. Life would be perfect if I just commit this one little murder.
Yeah. Well, and Lester's thinking that too. Life would be perfect if I could kill off this wealthy woman and steal all her money. So they're both thinking that.
Yeah.
Obviously, Lester's the worse of the two, because he started this whole thing.
No, it's her fault. She shouldn't have been a jerk to him during that rehearsal.
All right, let's wait and not talk about that.
Okay,
yet.
All right, we'll wait.
Victim blamer.
Hey, man, I've been there. Me and Lester, I'm like, yeah, oh, man, I see where this is
gosh.
Going.
Okay. So Myra sneaks out and she goes to the apartment and, you know, she sees herself with the gun and just kind of horrified with herself that this is the path that she's planning. You know, she's like, I can't kill anybody, you know. So she hides in the closet and Lester comes to the apartment hoping, you know, because he's supposed to meet up with Irene according to her note. And he's kind of like, there's this scene with this little dog.
Yeah.
Do you remember the dog?
I do.
And
yeah.
It's like, it's a wind-up toy, mm-hmm. and it walks. And it kind of looks like he had taken something off the dog that was going to mean something. But the dog, he sets it on the floor and it just like walks towards the closet, yeah. where Myra is. And you're like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen?
Great suspense, yeah.
And it ends up not meaning anything, this dog. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know.
Well, I mean, if we're going to talk about it as a symbol, I mean, a dog is a, you know, a symbol of domesticity, right? A, you know, family dog. And this is, I mean, everything about this relationship is a facade at this point. You know, this is a fake marriage. This is a fake relationship. There, it's just, you know, it's a chess game between these two. But they're playing the roles of, you know, and I think the dog is almost, it's one of those indications, you know, it's like the white picket fence. It's never going to happen. It's a total, at this point, they're like actors in whatever play.
Oh, that's true. The other thing I thought was funny was that she has like a piece of paper with the schedule written out,
yeah.
of everything. And the camera's just like, you know, using the light to like highlight all of the things that she's doing. So yeah. we as the audience know, oh, she's got this all planned out. But of course she doesn't. You know, one of the things was Irene leaves the garage at this time. It's like, how does she know how long she's going to wait for him?
Yeah.
So I have no idea. So Lester goes into a different room and then Myra sneaks out of the apartment because she's like, I can't do this. But then he hears her. Or sees that the closet door is open. And so now we get this amazing chase through San Francisco.
Yeah, it's great.
So he's chasing her on foot, but and also in a car.
Yeah.
I think he starts in the car.
Yeah.
And she's so. Really bad at hiding. Like, you know, she's wearing a white headscarf. It's so obvious.
Yeah.
I kept thinking, like, just take that thing off. But it ends up saving her life in the end. But she ends up hiding this, like, I don't even know where she is, but he's, like, looking for her, and she ends up stepping on a cat.
Yes, cat jump scare.
Yes.
Excellent.
An excellent kitty cat jump scare. And mm-hmm. this cat doesn't look real at all.
Oh, you don't think?
No.
I think it just looks really pissed.
Yeah, because she steps on its tail and it's like...
Yeah, this is 52. I'm sure it's like a real cat. Poor thing.
And so he... so he's chasing her. And so then now Irene has left the garage. And so now she's headed back to the apartment. And Myra kind of gets stuck behind this gate trying to get out. But then... here comes Irene, and she's dressed. They're dressed exactly right. the same. And mm-hmm. so Lester sees her in the car and goes straight for her. And Myra is like, sees like what's going to happen. She's like, wait. I mean, that's very like nice of her to actually want to warn him like, hey, that's your girlfriend.
I think that's how you humanize this character. Because no, I agree. Realistically, I'd just be like, yeah. Faster.
I know.
Get her.
Yeah. I'm like, why would you say that?
Yeah.
So he hits her and they both die. I don't know. Now, that's the part I don't really find realistic. He's not going that fast.
Well, 1952, I don't know my history on this. Did they have seatbelts at this point?
Oh, yeah. Maybe no.
Maybe he just like went smashing through the...
That's true.
Yeah.
He was in a convertible. So, yeah, maybe it's just...
These are back when cars were, like, metal tanks. So if you crash one of these things, it's bad business.
Yeah, that's true. So I kind of found that to be, like, poetic justice.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, because Myra just, like, sees that he has hit her, and she takes off the headscarf, starts walking home with, like, well, don't have to worry about those two anymore. And that's it. That's the end.
Sudden fear. Yeah. See, Joan Crawford is wonderful in this movie. I always found myself compelled by her character, rooting for the character, and it's exactly what you said. It's in the eyes. She has the most expressive eyes, and sometimes too expressive maybe. But she's wonderful. This movie came out 10 years before Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is arguably her most well-known film. And of course, that also starred her very well-known rival, Betty Davis. What's interesting was that she actually was nominated for Best Actress for this movie at the Academy Awards the same year where she was up against Betty Davis. And they both lost. Mm-hmm. They both lost to Shirley Booth. But yeah, they were both competing against each other that year. But of course, Baby Jane's an infamous production. There's been all sorts of speculations about it. But she and Betty Davis apparently, I mean, it was like it went from being a figurative battle to being an actual battle, those two. Hmm. Kind of a legendary thing. That rivalry that went from professional to all sorts of weird levels. But that was the first thing I ever saw her in, was Baby Jane. And I was a weird kid. I saw it at a young age, and I remember thinking, like, this is one of the best movies I've ever seen. I just loved it so much, and it's such a ghoulish film. And, you know, she died in 77. Let's see, how old was she? She was 73 years old when she died in 1977. And the year after she died was when her daughter Christina published Mommy Dearest. Mm. I read Mommy Dearest.
Wait, was it about the real Joan Crawford?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
So Joan Crawford was a monster in real life?
According to her daughter. And there's a lot of individuals who say that they don't buy it. They don't buy the book.
Oh, you
know,
okay.
You know, obviously, interesting. You know, a year after she died, her daughter Christina published that book, you know, which of course paints her as an out of control monster. And then just a couple years after that, in 1981, the movie with Faye Dunaway came out. But yeah,
why are coat hangers?
Yeah, and I love Faye Dunaway, but you know, I think it's fair to say that film basically ruined her career because it's a turkey and it was embarrassing. Yeah. And after that, the roles for Faye Dunaway weren't quite as stellar. But it's a fascinating life. And, of course, Jack Palance, I mean, my gosh, he's in one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time. He's in Contempt. with Brigitte Bardot. He plays the sleazy American director, and he's great in that. He's terrible in that. He's always been really good at villains. He also played Dracula. He was a really good Dracula on television. And in the late 1980s, he had this big comeback. He's in another favorite of mine, Baghdad Cafe, a lovely film. He's the villain in Tango and Cash and Batman.
No.
He's got that great scene in Batman because Jack Nicholson is playing Jack Napier, and Jack Palance is the head of the crime syndicate, and he takes Jack Nicholson by the lapel. He's like, Jack, you are my number one guy. It's a very, very subtle performance. But, you know, it put him back on the map. And then not long after that, City Slickers happened. And suddenly Jack Palance was everywhere. I don't know if you remember this. He did, they must have paid him by the word, which is why he only had one word. He did this chili commercial where, let's see, I think what happens is he's a cowboy. He's sitting by a campfire at night. It's just him. You can hear the coyotes in the background. And he's eating this spicy chili. Mosquito lands on his shoulder. Bites him, mosquito flying away, bursts into flames, and then Jack Palance looks at the camera and goes, spicy.
Oh my God.
And he did a movie with Chevy Chase called Cops and Robbersons. I mean, it was amazing. Like, this is a guy, you know, my grandmother used to watch. Like, this guy was always, you know, playing a cowpoke and, you know, these different sort of roles. But yeah, just a real, real actor's actor. And you know, he passed away. Let's see. Yeah, died in 2006 at the age of 87. God bless him. Mm. And as I said, he won the Oscar at the age of 73.
Okay, well, I want to go back to the Sudden whole Fear. Premise of this film.
Yes, please.
Because
it's good. It's a good one.
Okay, because we watched it a couple nights ago, and I was really like, "Whoa, this was great." And I'm going to bed, and I'm like, "Wait a second, this guy." This Lester guy gets told he's not right for a part as a romantic lead.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on to basically screw this chick and say, oh, what? You don't think I can act? Guess what? I'm going to make you fall in love with me. And I'm going to prove that I'm the most romantic.
I'm the greatest actor of all time. You have no idea, lady. I'm going to make you believe that I'm this character. Yeah. It's great.
Like, that is so psycho.
That's the best. Are you kidding? As a former stage actor, that is the greatest revenge I've ever heard in my life. I love it. Like, yes, that's fantastic.
I mean, it's so crazy. And also to then, you know, one of the ways that he's definitely convinced her is like that he's like this amazing lover in bed. Like, again,
is the Olivier of sex. Yeah, it's great.
It's okay. I was just like, damn, this guy.
I love it. No, I mean, there's movies that kind of explore this kind of idea, whether it's like All About Eve or whatever. I mean, this is the greatest revenge fantasy for an actor that I can think of.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And enough time has gone by. I mean, you know, it's maybe that's the one thing that doesn't hold up. I mean, she does find him in a very random way. Remember, she sees him from out a train window.
Right.
So it is kind of like, how exactly does he, the timing of it is a little.
So the question is.
Coincidental, it feels.
Yeah. Like, does he see her on the train and then all of a sudden he's like, you know what?
Is he making this up as he goes along?
Yeah. I'm gonna do this.
Yeah.
And the part where he could have done that is when he talks to, you know, one of the train worker people, and he's like, can you extend my ticket? And I'm wondering if that's when he was like, you know what, I'm gonna just screw this chick, you know, literally and figuratively.
That's right.
I'm just gonna ruin her entire life.
Or break some bones while we're at it. Some bone breaking time.
Oh my gosh.
Spicy.
I mean, like, this is so crazy, especially for a movie in the 50s.
I know. Again, Singing in the Rain. And then this movie's playing. Yeah. This is the same year as like High Noon and The Greatest Show on Earth. Yeah, this is real film noir. This is gritty, dirty, sleazy.
Yeah.
Human compromise, a completely unreliable protagonist. And as I said, like, we like the Palance character at first. This film really does pull the rug out from underneath you. Yeah. And as I said, the scene where
because you don't like her right away.
No, I like him.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, this dude is gracious. You know, like, he, because I'm, you know, obviously I'm completely on his side here.
What? throughout the whole thing? Come on.
Well, it's a movie. What? Sure, why not? Who cares?
No way. Okay, I was
when he is pacing back and forth, not answering her phone call, that's where it ended for me, obviously.
Yeah.
It's one of these things where I'm intrigued by the villain here because he's doing something so awful. But no, I mean, in all seriousness, I am rooting, of course, for Joan Crawford's character because she's very sympathetic. On the other hand, it is one of these things, like, I do like his scheme because on the one hand, she's a successful playwright, but she has a lot of money and privilege and power that she doesn't seem to know what to do with or even deserve. It's like the fact that she's a playwright is kind of justifying her existence.
Okay, that's neither here nor there.
Well, no, it is, because I'm understanding his thing. It's like, you know, who cares? You know, like whatever. Like, she hurt my feelings.
Oh my gosh. She
hurt my feelings.
Oh no.
So now I'm just gonna take away all that money that
fragile, his fragile masculinity couldn't handle.
That might have been the last audition he ever went to.
It probably was. Okay. No, but she has some, before we find out that he's a liar, she says, like, he's never asked me for anything. All he does is give. And, you know, she's very generous with him. You know, like, you don't see them having any conversations about money or...
That's the thing. It's too perfect.
How they're gonna... Yeah, it is too perfect.
It is. It's a ruse on us, too, because we're buying it, too. So in a sense, we're also at fault here. We're not seeing what's really going on. The illusion of perfection, of normalcy, of romance and everything, you know, everything good in this world, it's all just theater.
Ooh.
It is. It begins in theater and it becomes theater. Their relationship is theater.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so sad.
Theater with some bone breaking. Gonna break some bones. Ooh, is that dictaphone on?
Oh my god.
Really hope that dictaphone ain't on right now. Because I was really hoping we'd do some bone breaking, but I don't want that dictaphone to record the bone breaking.
Stop it. Okay, would you change the ending at all?
No, it's great. This is a perfect movie. It is. Thank you, Marty. I've never seen this movie before. Yeah, I've never heard of this freaking movie. And I love Crawford, but I have not seen everything she's done. There's a lot of stuff of hers. The last thing of hers I saw, I think it's her last movie. It's called Trog. I'm trying to remember. It's about a killer gorilla. I think a TV turns into a gorilla. I think it's so terrible. I think it's the last Joan Crawford movie I've seen. But anyway, she's amazing. She's a wonderful actress. So yeah, this was a real treat. And to say the least, this was a Jack Palance movie I was not aware of. So yeah, I love this film. For me, it's a 4-star film.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
4 stars. I highly recommend
it. Please, listeners, check it out. It's on Canopy right now, which is a free site. You just got to sign up for it, but it's got thousands of movies, and this is one of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Canopy with a K.
Canopy with a K.
And you can only watch 3 movies a month.
Yeah.
But it's still worth it.
I mean, if you're like me, if you're so busy, it's like, oh, I actually got to watch 3 movies a month, and yeah, three is enough.
Yeah.
For me, it's like, that's the sweet spot.
Okay, so we both give it 4 stars. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't change anything about it.
No, it's great.
Yeah.
No, it feels like a classic I was just not aware of this whole time.
Exactly.
And there's just a lot. There's a lot of these, especially from this era of filmmaking. The 1950s, I mean, it's a lot of spectacle. So like a lot of films like this tend to really get overlooked. I mean, the prior decade, you've got Double Indemnity, which is still considered probably the definitive American film noir. But there's a lot of these great films, and this is one of them. I love the use of shadow in this film, the use of atmosphere. I mean, really, this is one of the great San Francisco movies, mm-hmm. This movie and Basic Instinct.
Yeah.
Very similar film.
Oh my gosh.
Lots of bone breaking in that one.
Oh my gosh. All right. Do you have any? I mean, I think we pretty much covered it all.
I think so. Yeah. No, I dig this film. I hope people will check it out. Because again, this was a nice discovery for both of us. And I hope our listeners will have the same thing. This movie is real fine.
Yes. All right. Well, we hope you check it out.
Sudden Fear.
And yep. That concludes our discussion.
Good night, everybody. Go break some bones.
Oh, please.